Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and a blockage in my fuel pipe. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, blockage in your fuel pipe. How are you, mate? That's another belter, I have
well,
to say.
Thank you very much. I'm very well, thank you. And you're looking very smart today. It looks to me like you've had a little haircut. Have you seen a little trim since I last saw you?
No, no.
Oh, really?
I'm not using any product on it today.
Okay.
I've gone for the fluffy look.
And what I've noticed, actually, you have been less product-led of late. is this a conscious decision, or is this a financial cutback, or what's the thinking?
Do you know what? I have found that the gel and the mousse is getting a bit pricey. So, yeah, I'm just nibbling back everything, yeah.
Absolutely, austerity.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, these are the times that we live in.
Indeed. So, should we get cracking?
I think we should, because we need to talk to somebody who, you know, listen, this gentleman, he's a smart guy, right? He knows about image. He probably puts wax in his hair too. Let's find out.
Well, let's see. Our guest today might just have about the best job in the world. He's the man behind one of the biggest automotive YouTube channels in the world, whose popularity goes from strength to strength. You'll know him best as Supercars of London. But to us, we like to call him Paul Wallace. Hello, mate. Welcome.
Hey, thank you very much. That was a rather lovely intro. And I kind of liked where you were going, talking about hair product, because I have done my hair for the podcast.
Well, you can tell that, you know, and joking aside, Paul, you know, as I say, it sounded slightly piss-takey before, and in a way it kind of was, but you're a handsome, good-looking man, you know, and for sure that's all part of your appeal in terms of what you do. It wasn't the angle that I thought we were going to start the podcast with, but I think it's all part of it, you know, and so you're a man like Jason who understands the importance of great-looking hair. No mess, no fuss, just great-looking hair.
Thank you very much. I mean... Well, I'm not sure my demographics on YouTube will suggest that I'm a good-looking guy. I don't know. I tend to look at the percentage male and female, and it sways heavily to the male.
Go on, what's the numbers? What's the cut?
I think at one point I was at around 80% male, 20% female.
Right.
And as I've got older and aged, it's probably closer to 95% male. And
I thought you were going to say it went the other way. I thought, you know, it started off heavily bloke dominated, but now that I'm a household name, you know, it's more 50-50. I like the fact it's gone from 80 to 95.
That's absolutely
That's good. But anyway, listen, Paul, thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate it. It's brilliant to have you on, because Supercars of London, quite frankly, is epic in the world of automotive YouTube channels. You've got just shy of 1 million followers on the Supercars account. Last time I looked, and about 350,000 on your own channel. When you first set out on this mad journey all those years ago, could you ever have imagined how big it would one day become?
No, is the simple answer. Mm. I started purely out of the love of seeing these cars in the flesh.
Yeah.
I grew up watching Top Gear, Fifth Gear, buying my favorite magazine when I was younger was Top Marks that had all the cars for sale.
Yeah.
Because I dreamt of buying one. Mm. So when I stumbled across actually physically seeing these cars that I was only ever seeing in either magazines or on my television, there's nothing quite like seeing them in the flesh. Seeing them in all of their glory. And for me, it was all about hearing them as well. I think that was really what got my heart beating. And going into central London, completely stumbling across this obscene amount of wealth and seeing these cars driving around was the real trigger point of actually not just experiencing it, I wanted to capture it and then relive it. So that's where the transition came from, seeing these things to then actually filming them, and then ended up uploading them to YouTube so that I could just continually rewatch them. And from that, so many other people wanted to do the same.
Absolutely.
So I guess cars were always the primary focus then, Paul, yeah?
Yes and no. There's an evolution, and I could go all the way back to being 5 years old and being obsessed with animals, because weirdly, it probably does start with that. So is that right? my obsession with animals transitioned primarily into birds.
Same with Jason.
We've all had obsessions with those, haven't we? Those little creatures.
Yeah.
My all-time favourite is the red kite.
Oh, absolute beauty. I didn't expect this podcast to be going in this direction.
No,
already.
Do you know what? Neither did we, quite frankly, Paul. You know, and that's the beauty of actually not really writing anything, is it just sort of meanders wherever it goes. But, you know, that's why we like it.
Yeah. So, I mean, to caveat your red kite, I think my favourite is the golden eagle. And I head up to Scotland quite a lot on the hunt for them. Yeah, I love it. But birds then transitioned into aeroplanes, naturally.
Okay, yeah.
And fighter jets. And I had a few flight simulator kind of games on the laptop, PC at the time, which from fighter jets, F1 cars. From F1, I think I must have been around 10 at this point, I started to see Michael Schumacher winning everything in the Ferrari, I actually want to see someone else win. And F1 hasn't changed in the last 25 years. But I realized that Ferrari also make road cars. And that's where the final transition to be like, hold on a minute, you can actually have a fighter jet looking thing on the road with number plates that you can buy and drive around. And that's where my love for road cars came, which would have been around 2001. And my parents just jumped on it. I got car books, I got car VHSs, I've got a Martin Brundle VHS of him taking a Diablo down to Sainsbury's and buying baguettes and putting it.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. And that's really where my love for cars has come from, and where the dream Lamborghini Murcielago came from as well.
Because you worked at HRO, didn't you, at some point, you know, when you were much, much younger. Was that essentially an opportunity to bring to life the world that had otherwise, as you suggested before, sort of existed only in poster form on your walls or in the magazines in your bedroom? Was it kind of a way of making that tangible and real?
Yeah, I tried to get into HRO, and it was my local car dealer, supercar dealership. And I went down there when I must have been 14 or 15, when we had this week of work experience. And I basically said, oh, clean cars, I'll do whatever, not knowing the art of actually maintaining these beautiful things. Yeah. And they said, look, you're far too young to be in and around this business. But when I took a gap year after finishing my A-levels, that was then a much better position for me, having at this point started Supercars of London, bringing that element of photography, videography into that business. So I sat on the front desk and learned a hell of a lot, and just loved being in and around the cars and kind of jumping in and out of them, taking the photos, and I suppose just inhaling everything and acting as a sponge to learn a slither of the industry, of what it takes to be working in the world of supercars. And I never once thought I'll be able to buy one of these Ferraris, but it was just always a dream of mine.
But this just isn't a passion though, is it? I mean, it's a business, and you know, there's obviously goals and targets that, you know, that you need to achieve. So give us an example. What are the goals for this year?
My goals for the last 2 or 3 years have massively shifted to what they were 5-7 years ago, where it was almost a repeat style schedule throughout the 12 months. So the car world, with events, motor shows, motorsport races, they all kind of slot into a very similar schedule. So we would always look, and I say we, Sam, Seen Through Glass, Schmier 150, Tim Burton, we all acted as a bit of a pack, and we looked at these pinpoint events throughout the year and looked at how could we create either a story or a road trip? How could we focus on a particular moment throughout the year and then create content around it? So Geneva Motor Show was a big one. Top Marks in Monaco in April was also a big one. And then through the summer, you've got a bunch of UK-based stuff. And as it developed and grew, it allowed us to visit these places. So in the UK, I'd say November to March is pretty much a write-off in terms of weather. So filming is...
Filming is difficult.
Once April hit, it was almost as though the season had started. So I would say for the first 10 years, that was really how we would focus on the content. Mm. As everyone's businesses develop, as everyone evolves, matures, and looks for other opportunities. For the last 3 years, I've actually been looking for opportunities to align my platform to businesses that can almost expand my what's the word?
Offering?
Use Supercars of London a little bit as an umbrella to kind of help other businesses reach a wider audience. And if there's a way that I can collaborate with those businesses that enhances my content, provide more entertainment, and benefit from the business and commercial element to increase everything that I'm doing, which has been fun. But that's the last 3 years. So this year, it's kind of a little bit more of that. I'm working on some really fun projects that capture what I love about my channel and supercars, but have that sort of business twist to it as well, that I can focus a bit more time in that, increase different revenue streams, and fundamentally be a bit more successful as a businessman.
Paul, it's really interesting. And also going back to what we were saying before about the photography element and obviously the wildlife, and, you know, much as we were having a laugh, but actually it's all part of it, isn't it? Because the photography is really important. At the risk of stating the obvious here, you know, you're a visual content creator, and therefore that knowledge and know-how and general interest and skill in terms of how you capture whatever the subject matter is, whether it's a golden eagle or it's a Murcielago or something like that, it's got to be captured in the right way, you know? And so from a very, very young age, and I mean this with the greatest respect, you're still doing those kind of little boy passions that sort of fueled you, but just in a more adult way, and now putting a sort of business perspective on it. Is that a fair sort of assessment? And as I say, I mean that with the greatest compliment, you know, to what you do.
I'll take it as a great compliment, because I think growing up, I didn't have an idea on what journey I was going to take. At one point, I didn't know whether I wanted to go to university. I had all of these conversations with career advisors asking what I was going to do. You know, you'd go and do these questionnaires on a computer at school. One of them came back that I was going to be a forklift truck driver.
Which,
like, I don't know, maybe it was something to do with, like, I like cars, I like being behind the wheel of cars. Just kind of didn't give me the F1 driver option, it was forklift truck. So even now, like, I never really treat what I do as work. It never feels like work, which is the best part of it, which is why I take what you say as a compliment. It's just diversed and evolved into something I could never predict. And I think there's an element of being in the right place at the right time, an element of mastering my craft from the photography element, because that's really, like, my passion is actually just capturing content. I'm not an editor. I'm not a filmmaker. They're just kind of things I had to learn and teach myself to actually get what I was capturing in front of people. So I love taking videos of cars because it's the movement and the sound, but then most other things, it's the photography element that I really like.
So in all the time you've been doing this, Paul, there's got to be a couple of, like, you know, epic standout moments, you know, like almost like totally pinch yourself times.
Yeah, my first moment where it really hit me as a sort of pinch me was being invited out to the Detroit Motor Show with Ford. So up until that point, I'd had multiple meetings with YouTube management companies and people that I had pinged up on their radar that they saw a business opportunity to kind of help and guide me. And they were all saying, if you can get to the 100,000 subscriber mark, that's when you'll start appearing on brands, manufacturers' radars. And within a week of hitting 100,000 subscribers, I had an email from Ford inviting me out to the Detroit Motor Show for the unveiling of the Ford GT.
Yeah.
Right. So this was back in God knows when, 2014, 15 maybe. And to be given boarding passes for a flight that I didn't have to pay for, to be able to check into a hotel that I didn't pay for, and everything was included, and I was like, what is going on? Like, and then being ferried around, it was minus 20. So we literally went from the hotel to this minibus that had built-in Wi-Fi. And I was just kind of living in this dream world to be like, wow, this is where chasing cars down in the streets of London has got me.
Yeah.
Where am I going to be in 5 years' time? Like, I kind of really had to pinch myself. And yeah, thankfully, my girlfriend, who is now my wife, and my family were very good at bringing me back down to earth when I came back off my flight from Detroit and got picked up at Heathrow and went back home. And it was just like bouncing into this lifestyle that I'd never experienced before, never thought that I'd get to then coming back to reality and going back into London and putting my gloves on and my Umbro trackies and my running trainers to get back onto Sloane Street into Harrods to be chasing down these cars. So if I could still be doing car spotting 100%, I would. But I think the world has changed, and social media has somewhat pulled a lot of the excitement away from car spotting. So that's really where my passion lies still, car spotting.
Well, to that end, Paul, I sort of have this a two-part question here for you, and it relates to obviously what you were saying. The first part of it is, how does the chicken and egg element of your early days happen? And by that I mean that in order for somebody, a company or whoever it might be, to happily lend you one of their cars or collaborate with you in whatever way it is, they're not going to do that unless you have some kind of track record or following, or, you know, however that is sort of quantified, you know, whether it's 100,000 followers, whatever. So my first part of the question is, how do you go around that? You know, how do you get that first favor or whatever to allow, you know, to have a decent car to then gain the followers? Because, you know, they go both hand in hand. And the second part of the question is, do you think what you did all those years ago would be possible now? You know, were you to an extent riding a crest of a wave at the right time and the right place for YouTube? Do you think that if you were to start off now as Supercars of London in the year 2024, it would be possible?
I'll answer the last part of the question first.
Mm.
I think the world of social media and us as a general society has come on so much that we're so overexposed and almost desensitized to content and cars that I was very much riding the wave in at the right time, right place, right time. And I do see myself lucky in the sense that I was capturing really basic content. So if I was trying to cut through all of the noise now and trying to build an audience on YouTube, you see these guys that have car collections of 25, 30 cars plus that are worth in excess of £100 million. So how do you interest people to watch your content if you don't have a Bugatti Chiron? You really have to find a niche. And I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it's far harder than it was back when I was doing it, because you go back to the early days of my channel back in 2008, and it's a 20-second clip of a Ferrari 430 driving down the road. If you go and upload that now, no one's watching that.
Yeah. Because it's moved on, you know?
It's completely changed. Even the first 5-6 years that I was creating content, I never put my face in front of the camera. I was terrified of what my friends at school would think. I never told them what I was doing, and I was always scared that I had this hidden secret. Whilst they were out either playing football or going down the park and drinking alcohol, I was getting ready to go into London the next day to chase after some Bentley or Rolls Royce, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
So I was very, very self-conscious of what I was doing. And it was only after 6 years that I then started to bring my personality into the content and started to tell my story. And that's really when everything started to accelerate. So it's far more difficult. I would say near on impossible unless you start with a lot of money or you have a production crew behind, but you're seeing a lot of these channels now almost go bust because they can't compete with other people. And I've completely forgotten what the first part of your question
was. The first part of the question was just, I asked you a lot there all in one go. The first part was how do you navigate that chicken and egg scenario whereby you need to, you know, in other words, who was the first person, if you like, this might be an easier way of saying it, who was the first person or the first sort of group to do you a favor and actually lend you something and kind of go, do you know what, actually, Paul, go on then, you know, here's something, go for it, which in turn would have obviously helped your followers.
Yeah, so... insurance was my biggest problem because my channel started to gain traction when I was about 23, 24.
Yeah.
Which I knew at 25, that's when car insurance becomes, in theory, cheaper.
Slightly.
Not anymore, it doesn't.
No.
It might well do with Adrian Flux, obviously.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, true. They can tailor a quote to your exact needs and needs. Help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I had a contact. He was a sales guy at my local Audi dealership because I had at one point gone in with a friend of mine to try and buy the first generation Audi R8. Not me personally, but I'd gone in. And that was the initial realization that network is really important because this sales guy was the Audi R8 specialist, and me just meeting him and explaining what I did, he took an interest in that, took it up to the dealership director. He didn't give me an R8 to drive, but what we did do over a 2-3 year period, and it did take that long, was eventually I managed to convince the dealer principal, who also ran a BMW dealership, that I could drive, I think it was the first i3. They gave me the i3, and I think they thought, if this comes back in one piece, we might give him another car. So I then, off the back of that, I borrowed a BMW i8 for the weekend. So that was the first time I experienced someone lending me a car.
Yeah.
In the hope that I would then give them exposure and create content around the car. And I think I made 2 or 3 videos. So I kind of delivered my end of the bargain. I handed the car back in one piece. They seemed happy. And from there, I built a relationship with that dealer network. I had an M3 from them. I had an M4. And I think they started to understand the benefit of this.
Yep.
And where I've come from and probably been brought up is, I'm incredibly grateful of the position that I'm in, and I'm very lucky to be in the position that I'm in. So I always take that into every new relationship I have or every existing relationship I have. And because I've been doing this so long, I really still appreciate everything that I get to do.
Yeah.
And I think that goes a long way.
Of course.
From a loyalty perspective, from a trust and reputation as well, which it does allow me to be able to drive some ridiculous cars that I just can't believe that I've been lucky enough to experience some in the way that I have. And I would say it comes down to a lot of the character and how you present yourself and then what you provide in the back end from a deliverable perspective that gives the business the best experience possible to then return and come back and continue to work together.
It's an interesting question you mentioned that, Dave, because, you know, I've got obviously been involved with car TV for many, many years.
Mm.
Certainly the last, let's think, I think the last eight or so years, it's become more and more difficult for our production people to book in cars.
Yeah.
And because of the way we generally film, so we need a circuit. So, you know, we've only got a finite number of days when a circuit's available.
Yeah.
We're available. All the right camera crew are available. So
herding cats, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Mm. And in the old days, it was very easy because it was only us, Top Gear, probably it. Mm. Now it's quite difficult to get cars out of manufacturers because they go, oh, well, that influence has got it. And we're going, who the fuck is that?
Mm.
They've got no following. We're on primetime TV. We need that car. You know, this is what, and it's tricky to get them now because the cars are being used, and it's not like the old days where they had a fleet of them. They've probably only got one or two cars on their press fleet now because everyone's cutting back.
You're completely right. From the conversations that I've had at the beginning of the year, I've heard from manufacturers that people are now coming out of the woodwork and almost going, hey, I've got a wedding in Spain, like you've got a car, like as a substitute to a rental car, like
yeah. I'll take some pictures on the way down. You know
exactly if they've got a following and don't quite understand what goes on behind the scenes, and then what they need to actually deliver to help with the relationship with manufacturers back and forth.
Yeah,
I think some people do see these press guys going out to Instagram people like myself, not understanding the relationship and going, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, well, yeah, like I'll just get one of them rather than the rental car because it'll be free.
I know. I think they've worked that out now and they're starting to get rid of the wheat for the chaff type thing. And that's good. That's good for everyone.
Exactly.
Because it was getting a bit out of shape, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, even I reached out to Alfa Romeo recently because I've got the Stelvio Quadrifoglio, like the first generation, and the new ones come out. So I've dropped them a message and we're what sort of end of March. And they've gone, well, yeah, it's looking like end of spring, beginning of summer that we'll be able to get it out to you. And I'm like, that's fine. Thankfully, I'm not that time sensitive. But for you guys that have the track, the production crew, everything ready to go, that's not good enough.
I think also, as you said before, Paul, you know, it also boils down to, there's a huge amount of weight in being respectful, you know, having gratitude, being polite, ultimately being a decent person and not being a dick, you know, because if you do act like a dick with these people, you'll do it once or twice and suddenly then that'll be it. You know, there must be a lot to be said for where you are now and your sort of your career in this business is built upon the fact that your relationships and you've been respectful and then all these people talk as well. You know, so the people at BMW talk to Audi and the people at Audi talk to Alfa, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really important.
I've always maintained that I've met some very interesting people.
I bet.
Events and things like that, where they're getting into this world with the complete wrong motivation and almost expectations.
Yeah.
And it was only 2 weeks ago I had a conversation with someone who actually said to me, was that I was very against having someone like yourself coming in and working with us because of my experiences in the past.
Yeah.
And thankfully, the 5 days I've spent with you have been an absolute pleasure and you've been nothing but gracious and a real sort of pleasure to be about, which was really nice to hear.
Mm.
But it's still, obviously, there are some people and the world on Instagram and the amount of people that have a number of followers that are looking to get into this world is massive. But some people are getting into it because they either want the fame or they believe that they can drive a Ferrari or a Bentley on the weekend and they can do it, which, there's a whole long journey that a lot of people don't see that goes into it.
Yeah. And like Dave said, it is a particularly small little world, isn't it? This automotive world we're in.
Mm.
And everybody does know each other.
100%. I picked up that very quickly. Even what I would describe as the supercar owners world in the UK. Everyone knows everyone. And that I realized very quick when you just have these initial conversations, but it's so cool because everyone does know everyone. So you've always got stories to share. And whenever you see someone, you haven't seen them in 6 months, it's like seeing an old friend again. And it is a super cool place to be.
Yeah.
So come on then. Here's a question for you. And I'll start this off by throwing a bit of fun at myself. You must have upset a manufacturer along the way. And I'll give you an example, right? I really upset years ago, really upset Jaguar. Because I did an item in Oxford with a, I can't remember which Jag it was, and we got a makeup department to put prosthetics on me and make me out to be like an old man. And do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I just pitched this as an old man's car, and they went up the wall. And we were banned. We were banned from. I was officially banned from ever receiving a Jaguar PR car for maybe 3 or 4 years. And the same things happened a long, long time ago with Fiat. And I didn't even know this. And I was filming last week and found out that I was banned by Fiat for like 3-4 years. I'm like, really? He said, yeah. So come on, you must have upset a few manufacturers along the way. Or is your content not as critical as, say, ours would be?
I would like to think there's definitely a political side to this world that, when I first got into it, I was absolutely playing it, thinking, well, if I say anything bad, am I going to get my back?
Yeah.
And I want to keep everyone happy. And it was real just sort of trying to play everyone and be as bland in a way. And I never really talked about the negatives. However, like, the older I've got, the more frustrated I can get in with certain cars, certain manufacturers, and I start to see a bit more of the bigger picture. And maybe it's at the point where I'm like, well, who cares? Like, if I say something bad. And I'm not sure whether it will come as a surprise that I annoyed Ferrari.
did you really? I mean, they can be quite hard work. We won't mention names, but it's, you know, my Christian name is quite popular in that world. they can be tricky, can't they?
They can be very, very difficult. And I've been lucky enough to experience a couple of moments with Ferrari in Italy. So I'm very, very pleased that I was able to drive the Fiorano track. However, I took a GT4C Lusso on like a week loan. And at the time, they were quite new, but new enough to have quite a chunk of depreciation. And I was in and around the time where I loved talking about the running costs of cars. Because to me, when I was growing up, I was fascinated at what these kind of things cost. You always hear about high maintenance costs in supercars, and performance cars are very expensive to run. And what I did in this video was not only take the sort of running costs of the car, like fuel, insurance, finance, I also incorporated about 120 grand worth of depreciation and then divided that across the months and added it to the rest of the numbers. And I think I came out with, like, this car for 1 year is going to cost you $7,500 a month.
Yeah.
And I handed the car back and went, great, thanks so much. And it was only until 2 years later that Sam told me.
Yeah,
it was Sam who said that he had spoken to Ferrari and said, apparently, I'm banned from taking press cars. And
I love it.
It was like the only way that he'll ever be allowed back into the Ferrari family is if he buys one.
Right, okay.
Is that right?
And I was like, Jesus.
Paul, here's a question for you. And obviously, I don't want to go into the whys and the wherefores of why Top Gear isn't continuing for obvious reasons. But for somebody that does what you do, and it just dawned on me before when we're obviously talking about your online content and traditional, you know, motoring content on the telly, does the absence of something like Top Gear, which has been such an important thing, is that good for business for you?
I think There was a real sweet spot where I saw massive growth, and it's quite hard to concentrate because downstairs they've decided to start cutting up some trees into like a tree chipper. So if you
I wonder what that was.
I had the window open. I had to run and shut it. It's terrible. But when Top Gear originally got taken off air, where it was kind of no one knew what was going on. It was after the scuffle with Clarkson.
Sure.
Whoever it was.
Yeah. The producer.
I created a YouTube series that went out at Sunday 8 p.m. and I literally called it Top Gear Substitution. Mm. And I actually focused a lot on trying to create an episode that did more than car spotting or whatever, that just kind of gave people something to watch as a substitute for Top Gear. And I actually think the hardest thing for those guys was to stay on top of everything that was coming out and being immediate, because in the world of YouTube and social media, it's instant. I can make a video, a car can be released in 15 minutes. I can make a video and it can be out in an hour.
Yeah.
Whereas the guys at Top Gear, obviously they're trying to get the cars in, they're going on a road trip and they're talking about the Top Gear news or whatever. And the news always was kind of out of date because of their filming schedule. Mm. And I think now it's, going back to what I was talking about before, there's so much content. When I was really growing and enjoying creating all of this content, I was one of five YouTubers in the UK. So if we all uploaded a video at the same time and it was 10 minutes, our subscriber pool could watch all of them within it taking an hour of their time. Whereas now there's 50 in the UK, but there's the American guys, there's the Middle Eastern guys, there's the Australian guys. And now you've really got to either have like the most interesting bit of content, or otherwise the audience are just going to cherry pick and they'll come in and they'll watch a minute of one video, feel like they've caught up, go in and watch another minute of another video. And it got to the point where if you weren't buying a 750 grand car, your videos weren't getting watched because someone else was.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. It makes sense because it's now, as you say, it's quite a crowded marketplace. You know?
Absolutely.
But I just thought it was interesting just in terms of obviously Top Gear's absence now. It's been there forever. Arguably, it's been the inspiration for all of us, you know, in terms of what we do. And now it's not there, which is very sad. But anyway, we won't discuss the reasons behind that. And we should actually go back in time, I think, Paul, because I want to go back to your early days and your passing of your driving test in terms of that rite of passage. Because for me, right, I'll be honest, in terms of GCSEs or A-levels or I went to uni and stuff, they pale into insignificance. Passing my driving test was way more important than anything else. Was that the same for you? Because I suspect it possibly was.
It was, not because I wanted to be driving, because I was in competition with my older brother.
Right.
So I don't want to get the number wrong, but I almost feel like he passed his driving test in 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So
possible.
I basically said I need to beat you, and it was as simple as that. So I had the same driving.
Can I just jump in? Is that 8 weeks after your 17th birthday, or eight?
Yes.
Weeks from, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Literally, yeah. From the moment you turn 17.
Yeah. Okay.
8 weeks. So I think I turned 17. I had a double driving test on my driving lesson on my 17th birthday. And
I like it.
Yeah, I got picked up from school on my 17th birthday by the driving instructor, and I just went out for 2 hours. And it snowed because my birthday's in January, so that was fun. nice getting thrown into the deep end. And I had my driving test booked. So I booked my driving test about 2 weeks after I turned 17. And I just was like, well, it's fight or flight. I'm going to have to do it if I'm going to beat my brother. And I had already done my theory. I felt ready to do my driver's test. And I booked it maybe a couple of days before that 8 week window. And I failed.
Did you?
Yeah.
Do you remember why?
Yep. I was doing a three point turn, or a turn in a road as it's called now. And the Vauxhall Corsa that I was learning in, the reverse gear was in the same place as first, but you just had to lift the gear knob up and then push it across to reverse. So I had done the reverse bit. I thought I'd taken it into neutral and put it back into first to drive off, but it hadn't clicked out. So I put it back into reverse. I just went back into the curb really hard. So I knew that I'd failed there. So I was like, all right, just take me home.
So your brother got one over on you then?
He did. However, I reckon
Was there a wager? Was there any wages on it or anything?
Not
on bragging rights.
Exactly, bragging rights on that. But we did have a wager. I reckon when we were 15 or 16, we had a wager on whoever buys a sports car or a supercar first owes the other one 100 quid. So I beat him on that. Yeah, I beat him on that.
Tell us more.
Well, I think my brother was massively interested in cars, not on the same level as me. And I think we would sit down and we would watch Formula One, or we'd sit down and watch various types of racing. And I would always say, I'm going to have a Lamborghini by the time I turn 25. And I would sit there and I would shut my eyes in lessons in school, and I would just imagine me driving a Murcielago to school. And I'll just completely tune out of the lesson. And I just was obsessed at this image that was what was going to happen. And I would always talk about it. And at one point my brother was like, I'll have one before you. Just shut up. Like, I've got 2 years on you. I'm going to buy one before you. And it was just that brotherly competition, because we had a lot of competition. We both played football to quite a high level. We both played tennis to quite a high level. And him being 2 years older than me usually meant whenever we ended up in a final of a tennis tournament together, he'd beat me. This was just another one of those competitions where I think if he actually, like, knowing his career path and when he came out of uni, where he works in the city, I think he probably could have afforded a supercar before me, but I got there before him. So,
well, you had something similar, Jason, didn't you? Didn't you set yourself a target in terms of, I'm trying to think what it was. Was it a Ferrari before you were 30?
Before I was 30, yeah. 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 And awesome. I just made it. Just
that's did, it. That did, is did it. What, yeah. Ferrari, what Ferrari did you get?
It's a 355.
Oh,
yeah.
Mega. Do you still have it now?
No, I don't. No, sadly, I don't actually. I mean, I wrecked it. I mean, I drove it. I drove it within an inch of its life, and it was, yeah. I think I must have put 35,000 miles on it, and they were 35,000 very, very hard miles, and it was. Yeah. It was a bit tired by the time I'd, and in fact, all the cars I have, there's a couple of shockers, which I wish I'd kept. And actually thinking back, there was a few cars I didn't need to sell. I could have just put them, but that was not the way my mind worked. I'm like, right, I've had that. I've used it. It's worn out. Sell.
Next.
Yeah. I mean, I had a 993 Turbo S.
Yeah.
So I sold it for 45 grand.
Oh. What are they worth now?
Half a million.
Half a million?
Yeah.
Really?
A good one, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, so Paul, from your point of view, obviously as someone who, you know, has had many cars over the years in terms of you doing this, what's your biggest motoring mistake in that respect? What's the love that you lost that you wish you could go back and say, oh, I wish I'd never sold?
I could probably get all deep and meaningful with this question, because I'm a little bit like Jason in the sense, like, once you're done with a car, I don't get emotionally attached to it. And I just go, I don't want it anymore. I'm done with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's one of the things that, especially family, friends, and people that know what I do don't quite understand, because they do get attached and they name their cars, or like I got asked the other day by my cousin whether my R8 is a he or a her, and I was like, it's just an it.
Yeah. get out of my house.
Yeah.
Don't ever ask me that. It's ridiculous, isn't it? People sex their cars and name them.
Yeah, so The one car that was always my poster car was obviously the Murcielago, in particular the LP640. Yeah. And I ended up buying one in 2018. And it was just this ultimate moment where I'd almost done everything that I had done in my life, probably from the age of 15 years old up until this moment, was geared towards buying this car. I absolutely loved that car. And I've erased every bad thing about that car from my brain. So all of my memories are the good stuff. And I'm like, what a car that was. And it sounded like a fighter jet.
Did you enjoy driving it? Because I liked the look of it and the fit and the idea of it and the sound, but it was a bit of a barge, I thought.
Yeah.
It was a bit heavy, just not very nice.
Terrible at slow speeds, an awkward driving position, a tiny steering wheel in a car that's absolutely massive. And it felt massive. And I think all of my cars, you could probably say I've bought not because of how they drive. I've never gone after a car based on how enjoyable it is to drive. It's definitely a look and a sound thing.
Here's a question for you. And this might take a bit of bottle to admit this, but
go on.
Out of all the supercars which I've ever been in, and that not necessarily my own, but that I've had use of, I felt real dickhead in a Lamborghini.
And
I felt less of a dickhead in a Ferrari, and I felt a normal person in a Porsche. Just a normal bloke.
And I think
it's just, it's what you're saying. Did you ever feel truly comfortable in your Lambo when you were driving it along? In a public place like a city?
Yeah, the Murcielago, I would say I bought, it was 10 years, I bought it in 2018, the car came out in 2006. I think by the time that I bought it, I think the likes of the Huracan and the Urus had probably taken that dickhead attention away from the Murcielago. The Murcielago was almost a modern classic, quite a cool car to drive. So I definitely got better attention in the Murcielago, I think, because people respected what the fuck I was driving, basically.
But I did
have a Huracan, and I did feel like everyone wanted to race me. In petrol stations, everyone was coming up, and I didn't particularly like the attention because I was lucky enough to compare it to driving an Aston Martin or a Porsche or a Ferrari, and realizing I'd much rather be driving an Aston Martin because the attention you get that is just like ultimate different. Respect.
Yeah.
People prejudge you based on what they see.
It galvanizes people's opinions very rigidly, doesn't it?
And
they decide that moment they see you in it, they build up a picture of who you are, what you are, some preconceived idea.
It's
very strange, isn't it?
And I think Lambo naturally have, I suppose, such an encompassing prejudgment of what you are, what you do for a living. And it goes all the way back to dealerships. I remember I did a training course when I was at HRO and it was all about customer service, how to speak to people. And it was really interesting, but it was other people from HRO that went there. So it was Bentley, it was Ferrari, it was Rolls-Royce, and there was someone from Lamborghini there. And even then, the person from the Lamborghini dealership said, well, our customers are just rock stars and like that's the people that buy Lamborghinis. Then when you're in one, you just get I wouldn't say tarnished with the same brush, but you kind of get assumed that's your line of work. The Mercy was probably the one car that, going back to the original question, the one car that was really almost like the killer to me when I sold it. And I realized I'd ticked that box and I'd achieved my dream. I started to drive other cars, realizing nothing's going to compare emotionally to that moment. And probably since selling that car in 2021, even up until this point now, don't get me wrong, I like some of the cars I drive, but nothing ever compares.
You've still got that fond memory, that love affair, if you like.
Absolutely, well, yeah.
It's like a first love, isn't it, really? You know, you can't ever shift that. And even when you're surrounded by the sort of beautiful cars that, you know, you are on a daily and weekly basis in terms of what you do, there's certain ones that are just really special. And obviously that's clearly the one for you. Two questions before we let you go, Paul. So obviously going to have a chat with the wood chippers outside.
Honestly.
You know, it's of all the times it happens here as well. There's guys digging my road outside, which and they wait just until we start recording the podcast. So the first of two questions before we let you get on with your day is this, Paul. Of all the cars you've owned, you need to pick one and one only and stick with it for the rest of your life. Which one is it and why?
I would pick my Mercedes AMG GTS.
Okay.
Nice.
I just, what that car offers as a European muscle car, it's got the looks that could be compared to something like an Aston Martin. So when you see it on the road, you're like, whoa, that's a sleek looking car. That's a really pretty car.
Yeah.
It's an absolute brute when you dial it up into Sport Plus or race mode. Terrifying with traction control off. And then it does the comfort stuff. So I genuinely loved driving that car, and I sold it prematurely as well. I didn't plan on it. Wasn't up for sale. Someone who hilariously and amazingly won the lottery wanted to buy
that particular car.
So I sold it to him. Yeah, he just wanted to buy my car.
It was premiumly priced for that reason, I guess.
It had everything on it. It had been tuned. I drove it over to the Nürburgring to a tuning house there that specialised in AMGs. Had 625 brake, 800 newton meters. It was a monster, monster. And I still, to this day, look an Auto Trader. I've got an AMG GTR saved, and I've also got a 50th anniversary AMG GTC saved.
Right.
I believe both are overpriced. So I'm just waiting until they reduce the price a little bit. Because I feel like I've not finished that chapter with the AMG.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, cool. It's a great car. And you're right, it is a very pretty car, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
It's
I love it.
Fantastic. And you pitch it perfectly. It is a European proper muscle car, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You had a fantastic trip in one of those days, did you not?
I did.
To Spa. Was it a Spa trip?
Yeah, years ago, I was lucky enough to get invited by the Petronas team over to Spa for the Grand Prix. And we went and we all travelled over. There was myself and a few other people and a load of journos mainly. In fact, Chris Harris was on the first one that I did. I did that trip twice. And we turned up to this hotel in Ashford in Kent. And in the car park under armed guard were pretty much every AMG that Mercedes did at the time. This was first trip was 2012 and then there was 2013. So obviously these are the big, you know, when the naturally aspirated big lumps were in them before they obviously reduced them and put turbos on them. But myself and Greg James from Radio 1 went over in said car, the one that you mentioned, and it was just absolutely stunning. I mean, it was just the most incredible thing. And as you say, just an absolute brute, a pretty car, but just with the refinement and the comfort. And I loved it. It was fantastic. And then on the way back, we all sort of swapped cars, and I came back in a C63 Black on my own, again was not unpleasant either. So yes, I
well, you
I
obviously
fully
behaved
concur.
Yourself, Dave. You obviously behaved yourself because you got invited back again.
I did, absolutely. You see, and goes back to what Paul was saying before. In fact, you know, it's nice to be nice, and there's a lot of good things that happen in life if you're not a dick. You know, as we have both proven.
So then, mate, me and Dave always believe that music and cars always go perfectly together. It's like a marriage, isn't it?
Mm.
So imagine this. It's your fantasy drive. It can be anywhere in the world. So where are you? Where are you going? What you're listening to? And importantly, probably most importantly, what you're driving?
Wow. What a question. I get asked a lot, what's your favourite car you've driven? What's your favorite road? I can put those two together, but add the music in. I'm a huge music fan, but for a very sort of niche and particular type of music. So we'll get into that. Okay. But I would say I would be driving Angeles Crest, which is just north of Los Angeles. So I'd be driving Angeles Crest towards PCH so that you can then head up the coast.
Yep, stunning.
And I think it's hard for me to go anything other than a Zonda Cinque.
Really?
just for the sound, the upshift, backfires. Like I've heard from almost everyone that's either driven or been in a Zonda, it's one of the worst cars that you can drive.
No, I it's not. It's absolutely magnificent.
That car. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. They are phenomenal.
Okay, phenomenal. I feel a little bit better. The Zonda on Angeles Crest, with the sun beating down, and when you get to PCH, I know the roads don't actually link up, and there's actually quite a lot of traffic that you'd have to endure between Angeles Crest and PCH.
Let's forget that bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the music, I've always said, and all of my friends will agree, that I was supposed to be born in America.
Is that right?
More specific. I'm all of my tastes, like there's so much that beyond the cars that is so American. And the moment I touch down in America, I almost turn into this hybrid accent of talking somewhat American with all of their dialect and but still having this trying to hold on to this British accent. But I absolutely love it out there. So the music is probably between 2008, and 2015, hip hop.
What an image that would be on PCH in a Zonda, with that badass music kicking out.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, what an image that would be. Yeah? Anyway, we'll be there. We'll be there.
Perfect. We will be there indeed. And on that beautiful note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Well, that is it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, big thanks to you, but a huge thanks to our special guest this week, Supercars of London's beating heart, Mr. Paul Wallace.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. Very, very good.
No, it's been brilliant. Thank you, Paul. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, folks. And, well, we'll catch you next time. Ta-da.